Hello, I'm Tom Kinsella, the host of A Shot of Jazz, and you are listening to KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio, whose arts, cultural, and music programming covers a wide spectrum of expression from traditional to experimental and reflects the diverse cultures Thin Air serves. Thin Air Radio strives for spontaneity and program excellence both in content and technique. And to that end, we present an interview with Herb Alpert. Our guest today is the legendary Herb Alpert. Him and his wife Lanny Hall will be coming to Spokane on July 27th at the Fox Theater. Herb Alpert has won 9 Grammy Awards, sold more albums than the Beatles, set a record by placing 5 albums simultaneously in the top 20 Billboard pop album chart, won a Tony Award, inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2009, was awarded in 2012 the National Medal of Arts Award by President and Mrs. Obama. And together with his wife, Lanny Hall, herself is a Grammy Award-winning vocalist, formerly of Sergio Mendes in Brazil 66. He currently, this year, is listed as number 7 on the list of the Billboard Top 200 Artists, which is just amazing. Last year, he had a new album come out called Human Nature, which has been nominated for a Grammy this year. It's a collection of original works and classics such as Michael Jackson's Human Nature, Burt Bacharach's Elfie, Don't Go Breaking My Heart, Elvis Costello's Look Up Again, and all reimaged. It's really great listening music. And he's also in the process of reissuing 24 of his classic albums from the original tapes, and 13 titles have returned to the Jazz Top Chart 50. He has 2 new records coming out this year. One of them's already out, Flamingo, as a single, and he has a Christmas album coming out, and he's on a tour. He'll, like I said, he'll be in Spokane July 27th. July 29th, he'll be in Chateau Saint-Michel in Woodinville, Washington, and October 22nd, Malibu, California, at Pepperdine University. And November 3rd, the Cerritos Center for the Performing Arts. I'd like to welcome you, Herb, to Spokane and KYRS. I understand this is not your first visit.
Oh, no, not at all. But gee, I sound like a real busy guy with that introduction. I feel like I should go to sleep for a while.
Well, you've been at this for many, many years, and bringing pleasure to lots of people for many, many years. How did you get started in music? Did music run in your family?
No, not really. My dad, you know, was from Russia. He brought a mandolin with him, but he didn't read music or write music. He could just play by ear, and he had a nice feel when he played. My mother dabbled with the violin. My sister studied piano. My brother was a professional drummer. But, I had this incredibly lucky break when I was 8 years old in my grammar school. There was a music appreciation class, which we don't have it much anymore in the public schools or even the private schools. And in this class, you know, they go through the classics and play music, and then they had this table filled with instruments, and I happened to pick up a trumpet. It was something that just, fit nicely in my hand, and I couldn't make a sound out of it. I was just trying to blow hot air into it, and that didn't work. But when I finally did, the trumpet was speaking for me. I was super shy. I'm a card-carrying introvert, by the way. But at that time, I was super shy, and this horn was talking for me. So, taking it to the present, I just feel like kids should have that type of experience with some form of creativity, whether it's, playing an instrument, dancing, writing poetry, whatever that happens to be. If they have that creative outlet at a real early age, I think it's a win-win because it folds right into the academics, and I just like to see that happen. I mean, I've been very fortunate. I know that, and timing plays a huge part in the success of any artist.
Yeah, when I was growing up, I had this same thing. Parents weren't musical, but I had the opportunity to learn, a little bit of piano and that, and I think it was better for it, and I think kids are better for it. When you were growing up in your early days, who did you admire as trumpet players and musicians?
Well, you know, I have a classical background, so I played in little junior symphony orchestras. But then, you know, Harry James, and of course I got really interested when I heard Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis and some of those jazz beboppers. Of course, Louis wasn't a bebopper, but he was kind of the one that pushed it forward. He just had a tremendous feel. And I was playing in this orchestra, and we were playing Pictures at an Exhibition by Mussorgsky, and it was orchestrated by Ravel. And I was just enamored with the sound of the orchestra, and I was leaning forward listening to this kind of a stereo feeling that this orchestra was playing, and I forgot to come in. I forgot to come in on my part. And so at that point I realized, man, I don't want to play other people's music. I want to invent my own way of playing. And that's what I started, you know, looking for, my own way of expressing myself.
Yeah, and I guess when you started out then, you started actually writing music for others.
Well, I had this really a fortunate situation. I was partners with Lou Adler, who's a dear friend of mine still. And we were working for a company that had that monster record, You Send Me, by Sam Cooke. We were staff writers, and we wrote a couple songs for Sam, and then we wrote a song together with Sam called Wonderful World, Don't Know Much About History.
Yep.
That song, and which was really unique because that's after we wrote it, Sam recorded it as a demonstration record. He just wanted to see if the song would work. So it was just not really in terms of his likes, not professionally done. It was just to take a look-see at the song. And the company just put it on the shelf. They didn't release that. It wasn't released as a professional record. But when Sam left Keen Records and he recorded for RCA Victor and he had a string of hits, the company decided to release that demo that Sam did and became a huge monster hit.
Wow.
So my point is, I mean, nobody really knows what a hit record is. And, you know, the public is the one that'll tell us. But that's just the way that particular record happened. So we just got lucky with that.
Yeah, and from there you started, I guess, playing for yourself, like you said, doing your own music. And how did A&M get started?
Well, in those days, there was you know, lots of little record companies operating out of the trunks of their car, and a lot of artists were just, you know, recording a master and then could take it up to a radio station. And if they happened to like it, they would, they could put it on the air immediately or maybe put it in the meeting, and they'd vote to see whether they wanted to, expose it. But prior to A&M, I was recording for a major company for about a year and a half, and I wasn't crazy about it, the way I was being treated. I was recording, and they didn't even use my name. I was recording, and they had identified it like take five, number 247, or whatever it was. You know, they gave me a number, and it was very cold. The recording facility was cold looking. It wasn't an environment that was conducive for creating. And I had that an experience about listening to one of the sides I did that I thought was pretty good, but I thought it needed a little bit more bass, so I put my hand on the bass pot, and then the engineer slapped my hand. He said, "Don't ever touch that again. This is a union house." And well, anyways, I filed all those negative things that I was feeling recording for this company, and I put all that attention into A&M after we had The Lonely Bull, which was just a record that we released. We didn't have distribution. We didn't have anything other than this record. Now I had a couple disc jockey friends, and when I recorded it, I played the record before it was released to my friend who was the number one disc jockey in L.A. at the time. And he says, "Where's the hook?" I said, "Man, there ain't no hook. This is an instrumental record." He says, "You need a hook." And so I called guy by the name of Ted Keepsey, who was the head engineer at Liberty Records, and I asked him if he had anything that resembled a bullfight. And luck be have it, man, he played me a tape he had of like 30,000 people screaming Olé and let me use it. And I put that right in the front of the fanfare of the Lonely Bull. And that was the so-called hook.
Yeah.
And that record became a top 10 record. It took off like a rocket ship. Luckily, I had a partner, Jerry Moss, who was more of a businessman. I'm a right brain type of guy, but he had this business sense, and he started getting distributors from around the country, and we were getting calls from distributors around the world who wanted to release the Lonely Bull. So we had a real network of action going, and when the Lonely Bull was in the top seven, I remember this distinctly, I got a letter from a lady in Germany who said, "Dear Mr. Alpert, thank you for sending me on this vicarious trip to Tijuana," which made me chuckle when I read it. And then I thought, wow, that music was so visual for her that it transported her. And I said, that's the type of music that's the type of music I want to make, music that takes you someplace.
Yep, and that was the iconic sound of the Tijuana Brass.
Well, that sound developed slowly, though. You know, when you ask me who my favorites, you know, Louis Armstrong and Miles and Clifford Brown and a lot of these trumpet players, that Chet Baker that I heard when I was in high school, I was trying to play a little bit like them and a little bit like each one. I had a little touch of each one of their sounds, and then I realized, like, who the heck wants to hear that? They've already done it. So I was looking for my own identity, and then when I heard Les Paul, this record, How High the Moon, where he layered his guitar. He recorded with his guitar, and then he did another recording on top of his own guitar and did a few times. Anyways, I tried that with the trumpet. I had two tape machines. And I went from one to the other, and then, wow, hit that sound. And that was the genesis of the Tijuana Brass sound.
Yeah, the overdubbing of the trumpet was just outstanding.
Well, it was timing, man. Timing plays such an important part, because I think if we tried to start A&M Records in today's environment, it would not have happened.
Yeah, it's totally the record world and music world is totally different from back in the 60s and 70s. The A&M signed some great groups too. I was surprised that the Carpenters was one of the groups, as well as the Police and several others.
Yeah, I heard this tape. Somebody slipped me a tape of the Carpenters, and then they've been denied every record company. They went around Los Angeles and tried to get a contract. I heard this tape, and I used to listen to artists the way I learned, what I learned from Sam Cooke. He said, man, people are listening to a gold piece of wax, brother. It either makes it or it don't. And he taught me how to, you know, like turn my back on an artist and just listen to him. Close your eyes and just see what you feel. And so I did that with the Carpenters tape in my office at A&M. And it felt like Karen's voice was sitting right next to me. I said, wow, that's a beautiful voice. It kind of reminded me of Patti Page and some of the artists I heard when I was going to high school. So I contacted them, and I realized that they were making music that was really honest for them. They were very passionate about the music they were making. And Karen, at the time, Karen was playing drums, and she was singing, but she thought of herself as a drummer. That was her strong suit. But she had this magical, God-given voice that touched so many people. I mean, I luckily gave them Close to You. I gave them that song that I got from Hal David.
Wow.
And that was the door opener for them, because their first few recordings really didn't connect. So they needed that one catalyst. And once that door opened for them, it was magic, because it wasn't just Karen. It was the combination of Karen and Richard Richard had a good flair for picking right the good songs, and he knew how to arrange them and get the most out of Karen's voice. So it was a beautiful combination, and it's so sad that Karen never really got to realize how many people that she really touched.
Yeah, the one thing I noticed when listening to some of the records like the Carpenters is that at A&M Records, the production standards are very, very high.
Well, you know, we have, we were always trying to make music that was not the beat of the week. You know, we were picking on artists that had something unique to say in their own special way. And, we took a lot of pride in making records that, you know, in 1962 when we started, there were a lot of companies that if they had a hit record, then they'd give you an album with a bunch of fillers, and hit record was one of the songs, and the other songs were like thrown together, it seemed like. But we wanted to make music that, was giving people an honest recording. So we were passionate about doing it. It wasn't about how much money we could make. We wanted to make good records.
Yeah. Speaking of good records, recently you've been going through and reinventing some of the songs, and I ran across your 2014 song, Putting on the Ritz, written by Irving Berlin. How fun was that to do?
Well, it was a lot of fun, and it was, I did it with my nephew, who happens to be our manager, Randy Badass Alpert. Put that arrangement together with him, and it was all we did this great music video that got a lot of attention. When you say how much fun was that, that's what I look for when I record. I mean, that's my whole goal is to, I always felt if I can play something that's fun for me to play, it might be fun for some people to listen to, and it's been working for me for lots of years now.
Yeah, I watched, watching it, you could see the dancers are having a great time. You look pretty happy driving the bus, and the gorilla in the background was pretty interesting, too.
Yeah, well, that was one of those sneaky things that they were doing in that particular period, like a little hidden little goodie that happens. See who's paying attention. A lot of people never noticed it. It's interesting that you did.
Yeah, they call that these days Easter eggs.
Uh-huh.
And, that was just great. I understand that you and Lonnie were recently down in New Orleans at the Heritage Jazz Festival.
Oh, man, we had a great time. We closed the show on last Thursday, or what the date was. Let's see, what's the date? It was the 6th, the 5th, 4th, the 4th, May 4th, in the big tent. And there were people busting out of the tent. It was a huge crowd. It was a wonderful experience, and it was a little daunting because we started playing and you could hear, they have this festival. They have groups playing at the same time in different parts of the festival, I guess
right.
It's called. I don't know. The grounds. And, while we were playing, I could hear traces of other groups, sounds of other groups. But it was quite an amazing night. That one we'll never forget, actually.
I was going to ask on your album "Human Nature," what was the genesis of it? What made you think about rehashing those songs?
Well, I always pick on songs that that touch me, and when I heard "Human Nature," and obviously the one record that comes to everyone's mind is the one Michael Jackson made. I said, well, if I can find a way to do this melody in a unique way, I'd give it a whirl. And then when I hit on it, it just felt right. And I only pick on songs that I'm a melody guy. So if the song doesn't have a good melody, I can't even play it. It doesn't, for some reason, doesn't come out of the horn right.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be as honest as possible as a musician. You know, I think the big key for all, I think, not only, you know, musicians, but poets and actors, you have to be passionate about what you're doing. If you're not, it doesn't work. It's not the same satisfaction, and you're not going to get the same results, the results you're looking for.
Yeah.
And I always tell kids, you know, that they, hey, what's the secret to your success? I said, well, look, first off, if you're not really passionate about what you're doing, about what you're playing, whether it's trumpet, saxophone, drum, it doesn't really matter. If you're not passionate about it, remember this. While you're sleeping, someone who wants the same thing you do is practicing.
Yeah. And besides being passionate, I know you also have a rich background as a painter and sculptor. How did that come to be?
Yeah, I've been doing that for 40 years now, and man, it's been great. You know, I never thought anyone would be interested in seeing what I'm doing, but little by little, it's really caught on. Got 9 big sculptures at the Field Museum in Chicago, and we've had shows in New York and across from Lincoln Center. It's been fabulous. I've been doing these totem poles, you know,
right.
Abstract totems. From 14 to 18 feet tall, and I don't know. I'm just another way of expressing myself.
Was it? Did the painting help you while you were on the road?
Well, the painting, you know, it took hold in the '60s when I was traveling with the Tijuana Brass and going to museums, and I kind of like gravitated towards the modern art section, and I saw these paintings that I said, a black painting with a purple dot, and a purple painting with a white dot. I said, let me try that. I think I might have some fun doing that. So I bought some, you know, a canvas and a bunch of paints and started moving paint around like a monkey, you know, just kind of spreading it around and looking for something that resembled good. And little by little, I just had a great time doing it. And I've been doing it for so many years now, so I've developed my own little style of doing it. And then the sculptures kind of fell into place about 10 years after I started painting. And this is, you know, the thing. I wake up in the morning early, and I think about all three of those things, to blow the horn for a while and paint, and I sculpt, and I'm doing what I love to do, and I'm a lucky guy at 82.
Yeah, and you're still practicing every day a little bit, right?
Oh, not a little bit. I practice a lot. You know, you never quite get to that place where you've perfected the instrument, so I'm always working on something, and Dizzy Gillespie was a good friend of mine, and Dizzy used to say, he says, the closer I get, the farther it looks. I love that.
Yeah, you never quite get there, but because if you do, then what's left?
Well, yeah, you'd never get there because there's just so much, there's the unknown that you're always looking for.
And like you said a couple of times already here, that you're very, very passionate of the arts, and your foundation has just been outstanding in supporting the arts with over $150 million over the years. And
said earlier, I'm very lucky that I had this experience when I was 8 years old, and I'd like to be able to pass that on. I've been compensated way beyond my dreams, so I think it's time to spread the joy. I think if you got this gift called life, and you're able, I think you have to try to help others, and that's I get a lot of satisfaction out of doing that. We're just celebrating the Herb Alpert Awards in the arts next week, where we grant scholarships, not scholarships, money, that actually money award to five artists in various disciplines that are in mid-career that just need a little helping hand, a little encouragement. So I get a lot of pleasure out of being able to do that. I just don't want to hang a Picasso on my wall and call it a day. I don't need that. I just need to feel like I'm doing something that's helping others.
And how does your foundation help the kids in schools with music?
Well, we're involved in so many different organizations that are helping kids. I try to get involved in organizations that have good management, and that one of the important ingredients for me is trying to get kids to get along. You know, I think music is really a good catalyst for that, because if you start playing an instrument or getting involved in some creative activity, and you stick with it for a while, you get to appreciate your own uniqueness. And if you can appreciate your own uniqueness, then you got a chance to maybe appreciate the uniqueness in others. And I think we could use a little bit more of that these days.
It's just amazing, how school systems these days are prioritizing music out of the curriculum. And I think it's a detriment to society.
Yeah, I don't think our political people understand the value of it. They're left-brainers, to talk about bottom lines and monies and taking things out of our country that really make our country unique.
I understand when you come to town, you'll be playing at the Fox Theater, which is actually a very interesting venue. It was built in 1931 to celebrate Spokane's Golden Jubilee. And Spokane's got a pretty rich history of jazz. Bing Crosby, Mildred Bailey, Al Rinker, Billy Tipton, Jimmy Rolls have all come from Spokane.
Oh.
And it really surprised me. I just moved here a couple of years ago, and when I started snooping around about the jazz world here, it's surprising how many people you bump into, and they go, oh, yeah, my dad used to play with, Bing Crosby or Billy Tipton and that. So you'll be coming to a great place to have your music appreciated.
Yeah, no, we've heard a lot about it and very excited to be part of the great festival that they're putting on.
Yeah. I'd like to thank you for giving us your time and talking to us about your life, your music, and your passion of the arts.
Well, we really didn't talk about my wife. My wife.
Let's talk about Lonnie.
Well, the idea that in 1966 I auditioned Brazil 66, Sergio Mendes in Brazil 66, and Lonnie was the lead singer, and I was crazy about the sound because it was like an unbelievable combination of a hybrid of Brazilian jazz and American jazz and folk music and classical music and African music. I mean, it was great, and Lonnie has this fantastic voice. So we signed them to A&M, and they traveled with us for a while. Lonnie and I became friends, and little by little, one thing led to another. We've been married for 43 years. So she's been the real love of my life.
Yeah, I've seen her on some of the videos singing with you, and also with Sergio Mendes, and she just has that sound that you can just, close your eyes, you listen, that's her. And
she's real. She's she's a great artist. She does it. She can't sing a song that she doesn't relate to, and she always tries to sing songs with a positive message to it. And she's in concert. She's a shopper. That's the way it is.
Yeah, Herb. Thank you for
Tom.
Spending
it's been nice
some time
talking to you. Good questions, and I hope to see you there.
Oh, we will be there. Thank you, Herb.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.